David here. Coming up, a Meet Your Guide extravaganza. It's actually part one, the first 25 years or so of Robert's life. I did a long interview with Robert a couple of days ago and realized even before it was over that the Tolstoyan riches of this guy's past defy being crammed into one podcast, even a long podcast. I mean, we're talking about a life, a real life, that's part boy's own stuff, part comic book, part English Huckleberry Finn, part Sundance Kid. Not to put too fine a point on it, Robert's busied every moment of his existence with grabbing all the gusto he can. And he's a great storyteller. So that combination, the material he's got to work with and the skill set he's got as a storyteller, well, it's a winner. And I thought, yeah, I'm going to turn this one into a 3 or 4-parter. So yes, this is the first episode. It's Robert's childhood, Robert's Oxford education, and the record-setting Grand National, the pounding down the straight, the cornering, the jumps of the first few years of Robert's adult life. We learn about taking swords into Oxford exams and lots of athletic prowess and castrating bulls and international banking and the great Pennine linguistic differentiator and milking goats and spinning wool on Scottish television and pony trapping across Sicily and one-arm violin playing and life on the snake squad and taking big, exciting theater to a tiny, frightened person and running away to the circus. Well, you get the idea. Oh, and for the record, Robert's the founding director of the Brunel Museum. He's had a distinguished career. He's a freeman of the City of London, rejoices in the rare privilege of driving sheep across London Bridge. Bulls were polled, they were invited, whether they'd like to join the procession. When they found out who the head honcho was, they all, every last man of them, said, no thanks, we'll sit this one out. Anyway, here's the interview, and remember, this is just part one. There's more where this came from. London Calling, David here. This is another in our series of Meet Your Guide interviews. I've got one of my favorite people on the other end of the line. This morning, it's Robert Hulse, who's had a very, very interesting life. He was the founding director of the Brunel Museum. But let's go right back to the beginning. I'm doing a lot of the talking here, and it's not me who should be talking, Robert. It's you. So I'm going to ask you how you got started. Which county are you from? Tell me about Robert Hulse, the little boy.
Sure. Well, I was born in Chester. My father's family all came from Chester. They were all preachers.
Were they?
Methodist lay preachers. And I always tell my father that I'm still preaching, but not in churches. So I was born in Chester, but we moved around a lot. And I've lived both sides of the Pennines, up in the north, and then my family, my parents and my brother and I moved to Hertfordshire, where I finished my A-levels and took an Oxbridge entrance examination and went from there to read English at St. Catherine's College, Oxford. So that's my education, or at least the printable stuff.
I'm very interested in these matters and know next to nothing about them. Is there such a thing as a Chester accent or a Pennine accent? Because I don't think you have.
No, I don't. Well, it's northern, and because I've lived both sides of the Pennines, I find it really difficult. But my Anglo-Saxon tutor had a game, and when anyone arrived, he asked them, so I'll do it now for you. I don't know if it works for transatlantic. But he gave us three words and then asked us to say these three words. And he gave us the words in different orders so we wouldn't be led by his suggestion. So the words were cat, cap, and hat, or cat, hat, and cap, or hat, cap, and cat. So say those in your preferred accent and order.
You want me to?
Yeah.
Cap, hat, and cat.
Now, so there you are. So that's where we're different. Because this is to the point. I said cat, hat, and cap. Because, no, I said cat, cap, and hat. Because I'm from the Northwest. And the Northwest has this long and valiant tradition of alliterative poetry. So Gawain and the Green Knight, head rhyme instead of Chaucerian, which is end rhyme. So all the Southerners said cat, hat, cap. But all the Northerners say cat, cap, hat. Do you see?
Just about. I get just about here a little bit.
So it's to do with, it's a Northern poetic tradition. That the, the Northwesterners especially, Gawain and the Green Knight, this wonderful alliterative poem, is from the Wirral, which is in Cheshire, which is the last wilderness in England. So the first thing is the head rhymes. The second thing about being a Northerner, and I've not lost that, I still like head rhymes. But the second thing, of course, is the vowel length. So when I was a child, I used to have a bath and play on the grass. But when I moved to Hertfordshire, I used to have baths and play on the grass.
So you talked the way I talked when you were a kid then.
Yeah, that's right.
You had an American accent. What a pity you lost it.
I lost my American accent.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
But I still have the interest in... Northerners are easier to understand because we sound all the consonants. So my aunt, you might say, can't you see? But she would say, can you not see? So it's all out there. It's all clear. It's all enunciated. And... when I've been teaching abroad, people have often said how much easier it is to understand me because of that northern thing, which you think I've lost, but I haven't. That's a long story.
No, it's great, though. Did that brainy Oxford tutor of yours have any understanding why all of this came about, how it came about, why it was the case that there's this alliterative stuff up there? Maybe no one knows.
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that received pronunciation, or what a lot of us speak or try to speak, it actually comes from the Midlands. Because this is a small island, but people speak in different ways. And if you're from Cornwall, you can't understand a word a Yorkshireman is saying, and vice versa. Yeah. But you can sort of understand the people from Birmingham, and the people from Yorkshire can sort of understand the people from Birmingham as well. So actually, what I'm telling you is Brum is the lingua franca.
Interesting. So you got us to Oxford, but let's just back up. When you were a little kid, when you were 8 or 9 years old, Robert, did what did you want to be when you grew up? Do you remember?
Well, train driver, obviously.
Fantastic.
But also, I did want to write. I think from quite early on, I wanted to write and play cricket. You can do both. I've never done either very well. I wanted some work in the arts. And here we kind of lapse into cliche, don't we? The starving poet in the garret. I think at some level I sort of wanted that. But, you know, it's cold in the garret, and it doesn't always work. Day before was John the anniversary of John Betjeman's death. Who, wonderful poet. And he talked in Summoned by Bells about wanting to be a poet. Walking out on Hampstead Heath and sitting on prominent little hills and looking poetic and imagining people walking by saying, ah, yes, he's writing verse probably. But as he said, it wasn't good poetry. To struggle a long time to meet the aspiration that he had, the literary aspiration. Mm-hmm. So I think I've always liked words, and I've always liked cricket, and I've always liked preaching, but not in churches.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're being way too modest, Robert. You've written a couple books, and you write extremely well. So
thank you. Just me getting
that marker down. So a little bit about Oxford. Did you enjoy it? Was that a good time?
Mostly, yeah. Yeah, I had a wonderful time a lot of the time, but it's a strange place, you know, and I'm a grammar school boy from the Northwest, and the Oxford that I knew, which is many years ago, and I think it's changing, but the Oxford I knew was full of old Etonians and public school boys. You know, public school is for people who can't afford tutors in their own home.
Yes, that's right.
I always love that idea. Yes, if someone tells you they went to Eton, the correct response is, "Ah, poor thing.
Yes,
your family has no money."
Yeah, that's fantastic, isn't it? Yeah.
It's odd, isn't it? The Americans think that public schools are for the public, which is a complete misunderstanding.
Yes, yeah.
Public schools are private schools.
Yes.
It's very clear.
Yeah. Well, to the English mind. So is that when was it at Oxford that you got interested in acting then?
No, I did a bit at school. I did a bit of acting at school. And not much at Oxford. I was secretary of hockey. I left Oxford with a very mean croquet game. and played squash for the college, but mostly I don't remember what I did. You know, it's a beautiful city, and I had mostly a good time. It's this strange little bubble of privilege and wealth. I went back there. I taught, and I also taught drama. At the Oxford School of Drama, and we did plays at the Oxford Union. I adapted The Rime of the Ancient Mariner for a narrowboat descending Sandford Locks, which was extraordinary. I had mostly a very good time. Yes, I did.
So I'm interested in that. That final year, that third year, and do you know what you're going to be doing when June rolls around? They show you the door, and
I had no idea. I spent my last year out of hall in the idyllic Pear Tree Cottage, reading poetry, and I don't know if you know this, when you do exams at Oxford, still, you wear what they call sub-fuss. Now, exams are quite stressful, but at Oxford, there is a building called the Examination Schools where you sit these exams. It's a building built to terrify people. And you sit these exams in Sub Fuss, which is dark lounge suit, white shirt, white bow tie, gown, and mortarboard. If you're on a scholarship with one of the armed forces, then you you take the examination in uniform.
Mm-hmm.
You can take your sword.
Can you?
Yes, that's right. You know, the pen is mightier than the sword, but sometimes it's nice to have a sword, isn't
yes.
it? So and it's a week of examinations. It was exhausting.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know what I wanted to do when I left. So I went back to my parents briefly. I worked on a farm.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah. I was castrating bulls, actually, and there you are.
Oh, good heavens.
Yeah, yeah.
What a background.
I know. Well, and dehorning them as well.
Oh, right, gosh.
Yeah, yeah. You've got to do it young because they get very cross if you do it when they're older.
Yeah.
And who wouldn't?
Yeah.
So I worked on a farm, and then I travelled. Then I travelled. I travelled to Italy. I did an independent traveller thing, you know. I had an extraordinary experience.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't advise my children, grown up, to do it. But I did hitchhike through Italy. These were different days. I got lifts from people driving pony traps.
Gosh, yeah.
And I got as far as Sicily, where my friend was painting.
Uh-huh.
I mean, not houses, watercolors.
And did you sometimes sleep on the beach or under the stars or anything like that?
Yes, à la belle étoile. Yes, I did. Huh. Yes.
Yeah.
I think that was the most exciting time. Though Oxford's very formative.
Uh-huh.
But my first experiment with being an independent traveller was amazing.
Uh-huh.
After the rigours of examination and study,
uh-huh.
To be going where the wind or where the lifts took me, but with a goal in mind. And I have some extraordinary memories, actually, from there as well as from Oxford.
I expect you have a good ear because you're an actor, Robert. Did you quickly pick up Italian then?
Well, I have Latin. Uh-huh. In those days, to go to Oxford or Cambridge, you needed Latin and a modern language. So with Latin and French, I could get by. Yes, mm-hmm. And the secret is, I'll tell it, but you probably know. In Italy, all you have to do is speak fast, and every word with "ah," and wave your hands, and if you look sincere, they'll either understand you or believe they ought to.
Yeah, they're great. I mean, if you can say "buongiorno," they invite you home to dinner, don't they?
Yes, exactly. Yes, the man with the pony trap, he invited me to eat with his family.
Uh-huh.
And I said in my broken Italian, I can't, because I've just been bought dinner by the lorry driver who brought me to where you picked me up. And he looked at me like I'd insulted his grandmother. I suppose I had. And I said, no, I'll eat with you.
Very good.
That was my second dinner. So that's, a lot of that happened.
Yeah.
Of course, in the Mediterranean, hospitality is not so much a tradition as a religion.
Yeah.
The old mythologies, the old stories are full of gods who come to you in disguise.
Uh-huh.
In this case, as a young English Oxford graduate, they come to you in disguise. and you have to look after them and treat them nicely, or all kinds of bad things will happen to you.
Yeah.
So they probably thought I was a god in disguise, David.
Wonderful, wonderful. So you came back to London then, is that right?
No, yes it is. And I thought what I would do next is become a banker.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's right. And so I had interviews and job offers with stockbrokers and accountants and an international bank. And I worked for the foreign department of an international bank for 2 years, which I didn't like at all.
Uh-huh.
And then I ran away to the circus. I mean, people do.
Yes.
And I've met two who actually did do that.
Uh-huh.
But I joined a community arts group.
Uh-huh.
I ran away to the theatre.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was in Kentish Town,
uh-huh.
North London, and it was a company called Interaction.
Uh-huh.
And it was a community arts group that had a theatre company, a school for non-attenders, a city farm, a team of architects who helped with neighbourhood use of buildings,
uh-huh.
a publishing arm, some community workers who work with social services in Camden.
Uh-huh.
And a theatre. A theatre in the West End, the Almost Free Theatre.
Uh-huh.
Which is now a cinema in the Trocadero.
Well, that sounds fantastic. So was that your drama school then, in effect?
Well, it was. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I learned doing it, and it was a standing company. I was there for 4 years.
Uh-huh.
So we did theatre with under 5-year-old children. They were called at the time boat children.
Uh-huh.
And they were refugees, effectively, from Vietnam. They had no English or very little English, and they just arrived, and they were very frightened and very small. So how do you do big, exciting theatre with a tiny, frightened person? Well, it's a challenge. So what we did was we had dolls. They were the size of a 4-year-old child, and they were dressed in ordinary clothes, and you strapped their feet to your feet, uh-huh. the doll, and you moved its arms around, moved the doll's arms around, and there was a band that went from the top of the doll's head to round your neck,
mm-hmm.
so that you could face people as they talked to you, face children as they talked to you, and we did participatory theatre for under fives, and not just these very anxious, frightened new arrivals, but other children as well. They do say never in the theatre, never work with animals and children.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I did was work with animals.
Mm-hmm.
We had a travelling farmyard. We had a purpose-built vehicle which could take sheep and goats,
uh-huh.
and Jersey cows all over the country.
There were probably bulls up and down the country who said, no, I'm not going anywhere near that theater troupe.
Yeah. I guess that's right. But my castrating days were over, David. but what I did learn to do, it was called the Animobile. But what I did learn to do is how to milk goats, and how to make cheese by curdling milk, and how to make butter by shaking it, the butter dance, we would call it. And I have I have spun wool on Scottish television, which is a terrifying thing to do. Because you imagine them all watching you in their crofts, saying in the accent, I can't do well, that's not how you do it. But yes, we didn't take coals to Newcastle, but we did take sheep to Scotland and toured with the Animobile. And also, from the Animobile, there was a special operations called Snake Squad. And these were, well, we were investigating crimes allegedly performed by snakes. And we got everybody off because snakes are much maligned creatures. and boa constrictors don't poison, you know, stuff like that. But yes, I used to look after the snakes as well as milk the goats.
I mean, you're probably thinking, well, there's nothing much to all this. This is just ordinary. But to me, this is, what an extraordinary life you've led.
It was fun. It was fun. And because I like you, I'll tell you about the theatre we did with pensioners. Well, that's you and me now, isn't
it? Yes.
I don't know. We would do musical with pensioners. The performers we worked with were pensioners, and we tour around old people's homes. And the favourite, which I'm happy to share with you now, the favourite number, which you may know, you may even have done it, the favourite number was the one-armed violinist. Do you know it, David?
Was there Elliot Gould? Was that? Was it? It wasn't a violinist, was it? It was a flautist or something. Anyway, go on, tell the story.
No, this was a. Maybe you can do it with a flute. I'm not sure, but the trick is, it's all done in impeccable style, black tie, of course, and the arm that holds the violin is stuffed. It's a false hand, and it's up there, and you grip it under your chin. And of course, that's your left hand and arm, and the right arm is bowing in a groove manner. But where is your left hand? Where is your left hand?
Well, is it strapped to your side, inside your coat?
Worse than that.
Go on.
oh dear, how shameful. The forefinger of your left hand is dabbed with red nail varnish.
Yes.
And at points of climax in the violin music, the right forefinger dabbed with nail varnish would unaccountably emerge from your open fly.
Robert!
I know. It is vulgar, isn't it?
It's wonderful.
But it was a huge favourite. Yes. A huge favourite.
Is this skill rusty, or can we get you to do this on a London walk? Maybe on the prow of that boat.
Well, it is, you know, there's only five of us left in the world.
Yes.
It's a dying art.
Yes, yes, yeah.